This is a Harper Guys production.
The following will contain adult subject matter and may not be suitable for all audiences.
Imagine your friends letting you down, leading to your death?
Welcome to the gallows.
I'm Jake. With me, as always, my co-host Adam.
Yo.
Tonight, we're going to get started with our little PSA.
All right. So, visit us at thegallowspodcast.com. There you can follow and share, I believe. Also visit us on any platform that's available, mostly iTunes and Google Play.
Yeah.
Spotify.
Yeah. Anywhere that you get your podcast action, you could probably find us these days.
More than most, we will be there.
Yes.
Don't forget to check us out on our Patreon.
Yes.
Our that is www.patreon.com/HarperGuysProduction.
Yes. Thank you so much for the Patreon team that we have assembled so far. We really appreciate the support that you guys are giving us. We're hoping to get a little bit more coming in the future. We've had some opportunities to begin advertising on the show. We're trying to mitigate that, hold that off as long as possible to keep it to just content for you guys. So if you know anybody that's on the fence thinking about it, you know, a couple bucks a month goes a long way towards us being able to bring you the best quality show possible.
Commercial free.
Yes. So we appreciate all the patronage. Anything else that that we can get a couple more members added in here, that'd be fantastic. So we greatly appreciate it.
Absolutely.
So we're going to start off tonight. It's going to be a little bit of a discussion here before we get into tonight's actual story with what's going on in the world of execution. So this has been a big week. And
how big, Jake?
And it's not quite done yet.
Oh, boy.
So from our last show, if we back up to 7-8, we've been talking about him forever. This is going to be his last mention on the show for a while. Billy Wardlow in Texas.
I thought you were going to say Ruben Gutierrez.
Finally went down. No, Ruben's been stayed until September, so he's still in good shape for right now.
So Wardlow went down?
On 7-8. So that was the regular state-style execution, you know, done at the done at Huntsville down there. 7-13, landmark day. This was the execution of Daniel Lewis Lee. He was a federal inmate that was actually put to death. This douchebag actually tortured and murdered four people over 3 days. He was a white supremacist that had a laundry list of other things. I think he was involved in other murders along the way. Just pretty much a scourge of the earth to where nobody's going to miss this guy a whole lot.
Doesn't sound like it.
So things got a little bit wacky. Yesterday was 7-15. We're recording tonight on 7-16, just so that you know. So on 7-15, Wesley Perkey, who was to be the next federal inmate to be executed, he got a stay. It happened like this. Perkey actually has advanced dementia and Alzheimer's that he has developed while he's been on death row.
So he's a young guy.
No, he was 68 years old.
Yeah.
What happened was the Seventh Circuit Court said that this made him ineligible for the death penalty. Now, this guy raped and murdered a 16-year-old girl along with an 80-year-old woman within a couple months in 1998. I'm not going to get into the details of it tonight. Super grisly what this guy did to this girl. Well, the murders both actually took place in Kansas. That is relevant because Kansas hasn't actually executed anybody since 1965. Shockingly enough, the last people that were executed in Kansas by the state of Kansas were hangings.
Hmm.
Since 1905, they've actually had 76 executions. All but one of them has been a hanging. And the only one that wasn't was firing squad.
Hmm.
So they have a working way to go through the lethal injection process, but it's never actually been used.
They'd rather watch them dangle.
They used to. But since 1976, when they reenacted it, nobody has actually been executed. In a lot of ways, the state of Kansas has been kind of a joke when it comes to execution because they don't kill anybody. And what's crazy is they only have 10 people that are on death row. But when you go through and you look at the list of people that they have on death row, you are talking about some straight up monsters. There are two brothers out of the 10 that they're the Carr brothers. They went on a 5-day rampage where they killed at least 6 people. They think that they killed up to 11, right? Double-digit rapes involved in there. Double-digit armed robberies in there. Absolute bazonkers crime spree, right?
Jesus.
They have 2 confirmed actual like serial killers that multiple victims across multiple periods of time. The one guy was a church deacon, a softball coach, well-respected professional at work that was killing people on the side, right?
Side job.
Plus, so that's 3 of them. They have 4 more of the 10 that have killed 3 people or more, and all under aggravated circumstances, to where these people that are on their death row, they're terrible people that need to have a dance with the devil at some point.
Kind of like Jake's movie collection.
Right.
They got to have criteria.
I guess, right? Well, the state has none of these guys actually have a date currently set in the state, right? And they've actually talked about trying to get it taken back out to where life sentence is the worst that you can actually do, right? But the state legislature is actually saying that the reason that they are not doing that is because the threat of death being in place is a deterrent against aggravated violent crime.
It's supposed to be.
I don't believe that that's the case. If you know that you're never going to end up seeing the execution, how is that a deterrent? And then I was shocked that these 10 people, right?
Well, they're on death row, but they don't have a death row policy.
Right. Over the last 10 years, it is costing the state of Kansas an average of $20 million a year to have these guys on death row because of all of the court hearings and all of the things that go into it. $20 million a year. Now, the one bright spot that they have going on in Kansas right now is they have a new attorney general, and he is hard pressed to be getting these back on the docket. Like, he's going to have to fight his own court system a little bit. So the Department of Justice, so that's all to be said. That's why the Perkey case became a federal case. The federal case looked at this and what he did to this young girl and this old woman and said, no, we're not going to let this go through in Kansas because Kansas doesn't actually follow through on what they're supposed to be doing. So we're going to take over the entire thing right now, right? So the deal.
I think that's what the federal.
It's crimes against the country and crimes that either are in areas that.
Well, what I was trying to say is that's where I think they should take over. They shouldn't take over for Texas crimes. They should take over for the states that don't actually execute.
Right, unless it's like a federal crime that happens in Texas, then it does. Now, what's ironic?
I'm just saying it's less needed.
Right. Side note: ironic about Kansas is Kansas as a state doesn't execute anybody. They'll put them on death row, but they don't execute anybody.
How can you put them on death row if you don't ever execute them?
Right. But what they do have there is Leavenworth, and Leavenworth is where they used to execute all federal and military people that were going to be executed. So they've executed a ton of people in the state, just not under the state emblem. So it's kind of a bizarre thing.
They're trying. It's like smoke and mirrors.
Right. So The DOJ is appealing the Seventh Circuit Court's ruling, right, that he shouldn't be put to death because of his Alzheimer's and dementia. So by a 5-4 ruling yesterday, late in the day, it was handed down. It was actually today. I apologize. It was actually today that within 2 hours then of that 5-4 ruling coming down from the Supreme Court to override it, that they actually did his execution today. So Daniel Lee Lewis, also, he was the one from a couple days ago. He had his execution stayed by the exact same judge on grounds of mental competency, which there's basically nothing to say that white supremacist had any mental competency issues. So, again, within a few hours, that day, the Supreme Court was like, no, they handed their 5-4 down real quick. It's the way that the judges are right now. It's 5-4. It's going to be 5-4 in every one of these situations. There's 5 of them that are for it, 4 of them that are against. That's how it's going to be, to where they're going to have the majority in every one of these times. What's important to note here is that it's the same judge that keeps doing this. This is Judge Tanya S. Chutkan.
I knew it was going to be a woman.
And she is, it's kind of weird, she is the district judge for Washington, D.C.'s district, right? So what this actually does, which I find this to be bizarre, is because the federal institution is in her district, she has the ability to intervene in this kind of stuff, right? But outside of her, so she is the highest ranking, the Seventh Circuit is like it until you get to the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court has to keep coming in and doing this. So there's already an appeal set for tomorrow morning that she's going to hear. Everybody expects that, because we have one more federal that's supposed to go off tomorrow. Remember, we talked about this before, to where they're supposed to be 2 days apart, right? The old Monday, Wednesday, Friday this week. They're expecting that she's going to grant the stay or try to commute it. It's going to get overridden by the Supreme Court. Like, the Supreme Court is already ready to rock and roll on this whole thing. So the whole thing with Kansas is really puzzling to me. Why have it if you're not going to use it, right?
It doesn't make any sense.
It's just a waste of money and time.
It's like having headlights on your car, but you never turn them on.
Right. And if I'm a family member in that state that is dealing with somebody that my family was murdered by one of these people, like, I want to see this come to fruition. You know what I mean? They shouldn't get to hang on a death row for 50 years until they literally are gone.
No, I mean, do you think how confused you would be in the trial? You're in there, you know, you've lost a loved one, life is shitty, and then all of a sudden they've been sentenced to death. You're like, yes!
Yes.
And then all of a sudden you realize later that the state's never going to actually kill him.
Right. Well, one of the things that the DA said is basically that the lack of movement by the Department of Justice for the state and by the governor is that it gives him no leverage. Like, there's nobody that's going to cop a plea deal to life, you know,
why would they?
In order to help them out and get more information if there's more victims and stuff like that, because there's no incentive for him. Okay, they literally had a guy die in 2014, 46 years on death row. How is that okay? Makes no sense at all to me.
And he could have probably solved a bunch of crimes if they could have commuted him to life, or at least gave him the incentive.
Or at the very least, save millions of dollars for somebody that clearly needed to go the way of the execution.
Earlier, yes. Yes, I get it.
So it doesn't make any sense to me at all. So what we have upcoming now is we have Dustin Lee Honkin, which is the last federal case for right now. Coming up after that, we're going to have Harold Wayne Nichols in Tennessee. This guy is a serial rapist and multi-time murderer. Again, a complete and utter tool. And then we have Keith Wayne Dawson also coming up in August. That's the 28th of August. He actually raped and murdered a 10-year-old girl, and he pled guilty to it under the recommendation from the DA that he get life in prison. And the judge was like, no. You killed a 10-year-old girl, you're going to go ahead and pay the ultimate price for it. So super rare that happens, that because it's just a recommendation. A lot of times when you get these pleas done, unless a judge actually physically signs it, it's kind of a handshake deal, you know? And it's like,
right.
Like, oh, pulled the hand back on you on this one, bro. So they fought this one tooth and nail for years, basically saying that he took the deal and that he got screwed at sentencing, and it's ridiculous all the way. So
he got screwed. What about the people he killed?
Right. So there's another part of this I wanted to bring up that I found very interesting. All three of the executions that were done this week and the fourth that we are assuming is going to be done tomorrow were all done with pentobarbital, right? Hmm. So
sounds like something I used to shave my neck.
Yeah, Barbasol? Barbasol. So this led me to think, okay, what is this? You know, like, let's keep educating ourselves on the process of what's going on.
Absolutely.
Well, pentobarbital is a barbiturate. It slows down the activity of your brain and your nervous system. It's actually used as medicine in many, many cases across the country. It's actually all 50 states have this documented as an actual medicine, and the FDA has it as an approved medicine, which I find that to be kind of interesting that everybody's been freaking out for years that, oh, we can't get these drugs now, you know, to where we have to start having stays and not let people be executed for it. They've got this stuff right in the backyard that actually works.
Good.
Right? So it's actually used as an emergency treatment for seizures because it will shut down the nervous system. And it's been used to put down animals up to the size of horses for decades. Right? So this stuff, it is what it is. Like, they know how to use it. If it's used correctly, it works right every time. Right? It's made by an independent lab here in the United States to where it's easily accessible for any state that wants to get a hold of it. The drug is 143-0 when used alone as the only way to kill somebody with lethal injection.
Love it.
And with no complications at all. Like, there's not one listed as complications. The longest one that they had one that went like 22 minutes. And basically they thought that at the end of it that they just needed to push more. He was a gentleman that was a fairly large gentleman. What they had set up, they were like, no, that's not quite enough. So that they ended up pushing more partway through
that's
to finish it off.
Just education on what you're pushing there.
Right. And believe it or not, this is actually the drug that Ohio has listed right now as the drug that they are looking at to bring in. So no more three-drug cocktail.
Would you say phenobarbital?
It's pentobarbital.
Okay.
So I looked at it because phenobarbital is another barbiturate that's also used in a lot of the same ways.
But that's the one for – I thought that was the one for seizures.
They're both used for seizures, but the pheno, basically, it has the way that I understood it to read it. And if I'm wrong on this, please send us an email and correct me on it, because I want to make sure that I'm understanding the way that these drugs work and are used correctly. Basically, your body can only absorb so much of it, mm-hmm. to where if you get to your maximum toxicity level on it, you're just gonna pee the rest of it out. To where with the pento versus the pheno. You only get so much. The pento, your body's just going to keep taking it until it finishes off.
Well, we were talking about seizures earlier, and I'm pretty sure that's what we gave our dog was the phenobarbital.
Yeah. So the question I have real quick on this, because I don't know that I'm going to do Perky's case at any time soon in the future. The one question I have about this is, if you get a condition in prison that impairs your mental health, like dementia or Alzheimer's.
Yeah, you still fry.
There's no point in time that you think that the death penalty should be taken off the table.
I mean, prior to your complications, you're still a bad motherfucker.
Right. I mean, I'm
sorry if you got old and started to get your dementia. Yeah, you still need to fry.
Yeah. And then the other question I have is, with Kansas not using theirs, do you think that they should have to be put on like a time clock? Like, from the day that you say somebody's going to be executed as a state, you have 25 years. And at the end of 25 years, if you can't determine that there's a reason to keep them alive, when in doubt, you're out.
I don't think if you're a state that doesn't execute, I don't think you should be allowed to use the death penalty sentencing. Why would you?
I mean, that's a great question. They've actually been close twice to getting rid of it, and both times it failed in their Senate, once by one vote and once by three votes. To where,
you mean by bringing back the death penalty?
To actually absolving it. Like, they've tried twice to absolve it, to get it out of, to where they would commute these 10 guys that would have their sentences commuted, and that's the end of it. And it failed both times.
I tell you what the message sends is, if you want to live the rest of your life out and kill a bunch of fucking people, go to Kansas.
I mean, that's what it screams to me. If you're going to go on a spree, and
if you're this unbalanced, and you have to kill people, go to Kansas, because they'll let you sit in your little cell there for the rest of your life.
Right. So, Kansas, I'm a big Jayhawk fan, but get it together. You know, So hopefully they start getting things cleaned up one way or another soon. Either save your taxpayer money and commute them all, which I'm not a fan of, especially with the monsters that we're talking about here. But if you're not going to do that, it's time to start cleaning some house. You know, call in Mr. Luchter, get it all set up, and let's be done with it.
Grandson's a bad motherfucker. Let's go.
Yep. So that's what I've got on the early portion tonight. So I'm ready to get into tonight's story.
All right.
So Cynthia Sedgwick was just a typical 26-year-old living in Northeast Ohio in 1985. A group of friends of hers got a hold of her and asked her if she wanted to go to a George Thorogood concert at Blossom on August 6th. You know, they had an extra ticket. It's like, hey, you want to come along, girl?
We got an extra ticket, and if you don't go, it'll be bad.
Right, and I'm sure George Thorogood, going to see him in 85, he was pretty big back then. I bet that was a good time.
I'd like to see George right now.
Right. So friends and family would say, you know, this isn't a band that she would really be desperate to go see, but the idea of going out with her friends and party, and this girl was just always down to have a good time, you know? She's in her 20s, she's living her best life, right? So the group of four girls, they meet up, and they head out. And if you've ever been to Blossom, outside of the venue, it's a pretty good walk to actually get to where the show is, but there is a huge field where everybody parks. So people show up hours before the show actually starts and basically tailgate. And this has been going on for decades. I mean, it's a huge party in the outfield.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's usually a pretty good time. So they take some alcohol and stuff with them. They're drinking and they kind of make their way from group to group, you know, see what's going on, make new friends. This is how a lot of people do this up there. You know, it's a very communal, fun atmosphere, right? So she actually ran into a couple friends of hers from high school that I thought was interesting. People she hadn't seen in like 8 years, you know, to where they hung out and had a good time. And just so you have a true glimpse of who she is, she's about 5'5", completely beautiful girl. She's got shoulder length, light brown hair. She's got this perfect tan. She's outside all the time. One of these girls is obsessed over her tan. And this was like no tanning beds, you know, like this was doing it on your own at home all the time. You know what I mean? And she had one of those personalities that they would describe. She was one of those people that could come up and just start talking. And she put people at ease, you know, and got along. But she's also the type of person that if you ever offended her, like she's going to call you out for it. You know, to where they said in a situation where she was mad at you, like she could go straight sailor mode, you know, to kind of let you know what's up. So she sounds like a totally fun person to be around. You know?
Absolutely.
And I like when people are real like that, right?
Oh, 100%.
Well, they actually had lawn seats to the show. So again, to give you a better idea, Polaris is an amphitheater to where they have seats on the inside and then they have a huge lawn that's on a hill.
You said Polaris.
Oh, I didn't mean Polaris. I apologize. It's Blossom. Polaris is actually a venue that's down in Columbus, Ohio.
Yes.
Thank you. So the lawn is its own party in itself once you get out there. I mean, it's the same type thing that you had outside, only it's inside with the show going on.
Still fall asleep on the grass.
Right. So by estimates, they actually, under their guidance from the state of Ohio, they're allowed to have up to 20,000 people on the lawn. Like, that's how big of an area that we're talking, right? And everybody's dancing, partying, singing, just having a great night. Everybody's throwing down. So as they're working their way through, they meet a group of guys that are in their 20s. They're all tan, they're all well-built, and the one guy mentions that they work for a construction company, but didn't really elaborate much further than that. Well, one of the guys, he was pretty tall, he's about 6'3", tan, and him and Cynthia just started talking immediately. They're dancing, having a good time, just having a blast for the entire show. Well, at one point, George had the crowd singing along, and everybody's just feeling this huge energy that goes through the show. You know, and that's one of the things that they remembered is that it was just like a big sing-along at one point in time. Well, midway through his show, she needs another drink, has to go to the bathroom. So she kind of slides off to the side out of the lawn, and they've got like recession areas and stuff off to the side. And when she got back, she went from being pretty tipsy when she left to where she was schnockered when she gets back to the group. And she said that she had met some friends and were kind of BSing out there. And she hit the dube a couple times and, you know, ended up just BSing. And it took her a long time to get back. So, but she got back and they get back to enjoying the show. And things seemed like they're going pretty normal. Well, as the show is winding down, Cynthia and her new construction worker, Bo, they start heading for the woods. You know, the woods there are a little bit legendary for the shenanigans that go on back in the woods, right? Well, the story goes that he actually winked at one of his friends, you know, indicating that, hey, we're going to go get it on, you know. So they start heading for the heavy cover of the woods, and her friends remembered Cynthia saying, hey, I'll be right back. And she kind of gave them a grin too. So like everybody's kind of on the up and up, you know, like, yeah, all right, we kind of know what's going on here. You know, young people are going to be young people doing their thing. Well, as they start making their way to the woods, Cynthia is so wasted that she couldn't even hardly walk. And at one point he literally just grabs her and throws him over her shoulder. Right. And they take off and they disappear into the woods. So they get to the point where the show's pretty much over. You know, they've already had the encore and stuff. People are starting to disperse. And two of the guys that were in his group, a gentleman named Anthony Hone and his friend Jeffrey Earhart, they were also construction workers. They had given the girls fake names, you know, which I don't think that that's atypical. You know, the girls could have done the same thing for all we know. You know, a lot of times in that situation, you meet people you don't know. You know, hey, I'm Ted and this is Bill. You know what I mean? You're not going to put it out there. So...
excellent.
Right? So they are like, all right, we gotta get our buddy and get out of here. So they head for the woods, and they're kind of walking around the woods for about 20 minutes, and they're calling for their friend, and nothing. They can't get any kind of response for what's going on, so they're like, well, it's massive out here. Who knows? They probably already came back out on the other side or something. You know, we're just going to go ahead and go. So they headed for their car, got in their cars, and headed back home, and that was it for them for the night. Well, the girls were a little bit different. They waited out by the car to where there was basically nobody left, nobody come back, and a security guard actually came by and like, hey, like, what are you guys doing? It's time to get out of here. You know, the show's over. So they said, hey, we have a friend and she walked off with this guy and we haven't seen her. We don't really know what's going on. So they got a hold of some of the other security people and kind of searched the grounds and stuff, and they really didn't find anything that led to any kind of suspicion. So they said, you know, your friends probably left with other people, got rides going out. You know, we see this kind of stuff all the time. They'll be fine. Well, the next morning they have the cleanup crew come in, you know, because I'm sure you can imagine after a party like that, there's always trash and stuff all over the place. One of the cleanup crew workers actually finds a purse and they open it up and there's some money inside along with an ID that belongs to Cynthia. So they reach out to the police department. Police department reaches out to the family, and they actually file a missing persons report. Well, over the next several days, there's a bunch of attempts to try to get a hold of Cynthia. Every friend that they could think of where she'd possibly gone. Apparently, this is something that she had done a few times to where, like, she'd go off and she'd just be off the grid for a couple days. This is the 80s. You don't have a cell phone where anybody can just get a hold of you, right? Well, on August the 12th, it's been 6 days now at this point, they got about 100 people together. It was a mixture of police and volunteers, a lot of people that actually worked for the venue that knew the area pretty well, and they start searching this massively wooded area. Well, there was a parking lot attendant that was part of the group, and as he was walking, he saw this one area that you really couldn't get into very well, but he said it looked like something had kind of been dragged across it. So he got down on his hands and knees, and he crawled down underneath these bushes, and that's where he would find Cynthia's body. Laying. She had ligature marks on her neck, and her bra and socks were actually found tied together, but they were like laying beside her. So the assumption that they had end up coming to is that she had been choked to death with her bra and socks. One of the other things that they thought was strange was one of her teeth was laying right beside her, but it was almost like it had been placed there. It was just sitting there on the ground. Well, they would come to find through the autopsy that she had several blunt force trauma blows to the face and head to where that's how they assume that the tooth would have come out, right? Outside of all of this, they do find some semen to where they do know that something had happened between her and her mystery man. And they also find a pack of Winston cigarettes. So none of the girls in the group smoke Winston. And the one girl actually remembered, hey, that guy was smoking Winston's all night because I bummed one off of him and I don't like Winston cigarettes. So they knew that they had somebody that they were kind of looking for, but honestly, the cops had little to go on at this point. They had a description of a man. I mean, he's 6'2", 6'3", well-built, with a tan and a mustache, you know, short hair, and this pack of cigarettes. I mean, that's really about all they had. Well, it's ironic that through all of this, her desire to go out and have a good time with her friends for the night, they didn't keep track of her and they ended up losing their friend. I mean, I hate to throw stones at the friends, but I mean, that's like code. You know what I mean? Like you go to some place like that in a group, you leave with the group you came with, or at least make sure that everybody gets home okay.
100%.
Right? To where that's one of the things that really bothered me about reading this whole thing is like, how do you just let your friend that's clearly wasted, you know, go off with somebody else? Right? So the investigators get involved here, the local police department, and they decide to start trying to find the group of men. Well, it becomes evident really, really quickly that they're dealing with fake names. So the descriptions that they have could fit anybody, right? And you would think that saying, oh, they work for a construction company, that's something that we can nail down pretty quick. There's so many construction companies around that employ short-term workers as well, you know, right, to where you have independent contractors, stuff like that.
Sure.
It could be any number of thousands of people coming and going, right? So a few weeks after they had found the body, this runs on the local news asking the public for help, you know, identifying any of these men, who they could possibly be. They didn't really get anywhere, right? So that's in August. On September 26th of 85, you have 38-year-old Nancy Hale. Now, she lives in Goodyear Heights, right, which is kind of a suburb of Akron, and she's in the kitchen doing some dishes, something along those lines in the house, and two men enter the house, which she's unbeknownst to, and one man strikes her from behind and throws her on the floor. And once she's on the floor, he begins tearing her clothes off and begins to actively rape her. Well, he told her, he said, if you resist, I'm going to kill you. So while this rape is going on, the other man is standing near her head, screaming at her, demanding money and jewelry and anything else of value that could possibly be in the house. So Nancy is on the ground being actively raped in this moment, trying to convey to this guy what he's looking for because she's afraid for her life at this point. So she's actually able to direct him to the bedroom where her little bit of jewelry and a little bit of cash that she had was at. And this guy continues to actually rummage through the house while this attack is going on. So eventually the thief comes back, and when he walks in, he sees that the rapist is on top of her with her bra around her neck, choking her, and that she's actually like starting to turn blue at this point, to where he actually tackled the man to get him off of her. And he said, look, I don't want to be involved in a murder. You know, you said that we were coming here to rob somebody. You did what you had to do. I'm not being part of any kind of a murder, right? So the men flee the scene. Well, Hale, being the badass that she was, she's actually able to get herself together and get up, and she sees them start to pull away, right? So she gets a description of the truck and a partial license plate on there. Well, she actually noticed, too, that there was a very distinctive broken grill, that the front left, like, of the grill was missing, to where, like, you could see into the radiator, right? To where this should be something that's not that hard to find in a small area.
Sure.
Right? So she submitted a rape kit, and even though DNA evidence wasn't what it was back then, they tried to run some kind of a test against whatever information they had. It didn't come back to anybody, right? But the police said, hey, you know, the truck really gives us something that we want to look for. Well, the truck was actually located 3 days later on September the 29th, and they linked it to a man named Glenn Brenner. So Brenner was arrested actually at his job site, right? So he's a construction worker, right? Makes sense. And he confesses to the rape basically immediately. They end up giving him 10 years for it with a chance for parole after 5, which I think this is a different time when it comes to rape sentencing and stuff like that. I mean, for them to instantly, in an aggravated attack like this, be like, 10 years? Maybe you get out in 5? We good with that? That seems like pretty light to me.
Yes.
For a savage attack like this, you know? Well, another thing that was weird about this is he's not due to start serving his sentence until early 1986 for whatever reason. So post-conviction, he's released. So this blows my mind. How do you let somebody walk out of a courtroom and back into normal life? And, oh, hey, by the way, we're going to need you to show up in 4 months for your 10-year prison sentence to start.
So you can go out there and take your frustration that you're probably building up out on another poor soul.
Right. Or flee or whatever. I mean, there's a multitude of things.
There's a high lack of common sense there.
Right. So this leads us up to November the 19th. A young lady named Shelley Powell, she's an 18-year-old Akron U student. She's an athlete, a freshman at the university. in really good shape. She runs track up there, and she's actually jogging on the towpath up in Talbinch. And anybody that knows anything about the towpath that's up there, it goes for miles and miles and miles. I mean, it connects a bunch of different towns. I forget exactly, 120 miles of actual paved trail.
It's a lot.
I think it's what they have up there. So she's out for her morning jog like it's nothing. Again, it's November the 19th, and she's hit from behind, and she lands face down. This guy jumps on top of her, and he told her, he said, if you scream, I'm going to kill you. Sounds familiar, right?
Yep.
So a little bit different for her, though, is she actually has her head and her hands and her feet bound with tape. And then she's actually raped repeatedly over the next 30 to 45 minutes from what they can tell. And she's only about 10 feet off of this trail, right? They think the fact that it was snowing is what contributed to the fact that there wasn't anybody else out there. It's early in the morning. It's snowing in November, right? So you don't have the bike riders and the runners that you're normally going to have out there, right? Well, after he's done with the rape, he begins beating her until she goes unconscious. So she wakes up and she's completely naked and cold and she can't breathe, but she's still like disoriented and she can't really figure out what's going on to where she can't breathe. So she begins to make her way up the trail, up this hill to a house that she knows is close. So she gets to the home and there's actually a couple that's home and they bring her in immediately, you know, get her covered up to try to start getting her warm. They call the police and the police show up, and why they didn't remove this before, but when the police arrive, it's actually her bra that is tied around her neck that's making it difficult for her to breathe. So I was kind of surprised and don't really understand why the couple didn't try to take it off. The one thing that I found is that they kind of speculated that there might be fingerprints or something on it to where they didn't want to disturb it. But if she's struggling to breathe,
yeah,
be careful about it and take it off. But let's get this girl comfortable after what she's just been through.
Just get a pair of scissors and don't touch anything.
Right? So they take her directly to the hospital to where she lets them perform a rape kit on her. And then they take her down to the station. Immediately, first set of pictures that comes up, she picks him out immediately. This is the guy that did it. No questions asked, right? And they were like, all right, perfect. Well, the weird thing about it was that they didn't find any semen at all. So she'd been raped three times and they found no semen at all of any traces. So they don't really have a good explanation as to why, but if a rape kit's performed after three rapes, I have a hard time understanding how that's not present.
Exactly.
Right? But what they did find was a Winston cigarette butt laying there on the ground beside. So they took that as evidence, right? So police now have a positive ID on this guy. They know exactly who he is. They know that they're looking for Benner, right? To where they start a manhunt. Well, they check with his employers. They check his previous addresses. And they let everybody know, hey, we're looking for Glenn Benner. Well, according to his co-workers, he left shortly after the sentencing and for the rape of Nancy Hale, right, to where he had got out of Dodge. So they checked with everybody family-wise, locally. Nothing turns up on that end of it. He actually ends up on the top 10 Ohio's most wanted list. And finally, the FBI is involved.
Wow, I don't remember any of this.
I don't either.
Of course, I guess I was, what'd you say?
We were younger. This is 1986 now.
Yeah.
Well, end of 1985.
Right.
So they became involved at that point, and they're now looking for him for the aggravated rape and attempted murder of Shelley Powell. So they're looking for him. Nothing happens through Thanksgiving. We get all the way through Christmas and the holidays come and go. They haven't been able to locate this guy. They check with the families again at Christmas time, you know, thinking, hey, maybe this guy's going to show up home. Because a lot of people, even bad people,
sure,
you know, if they
can't help it.
Yeah. I mean, everybody's got a calling to come back to where they're from at right. some point, right? So this brings us to New Year's Eve, to where there is a New Year's Eve party going on. And 21-year-old Trina Bauer has this New Year's Eve party. It's friends and family, and they just have an absolute blast. It's the first year that she's 21 for New Year's, you know, to where she has some drinks, has a blast, you know, ends up crashing, you know, doesn't get up until a little bit late on the first. And she had the day off, you know, on the first, to where she just had kind of a lazy day. She actually had a friend of hers that had been partying with her the night before that had met a guy, you know, and they were kind of hitting it off. So she goes over in the early evening to hang out with her friend for a little bit, you know. So she's over there for a couple hours, and about 9:45, She's like, you know, I got to go home and get some sleep. It's been a really long couple days. Like, I just need a really good night's sleep, you know. Well, by midnight, she hasn't returned back home. She lives with her parents at the time. And they said it's just not like her to not come home. So they knew the friend's house she was at. They call her, wake her up, and she's like, no, she left a couple hours ago. You know, I'm not really sure. Hmm. Well, this was a really bright young woman. And her family would talk about her as being somebody that she just had a passion for helping people, you know, to where she would stop if somebody was stranded on the side of the road. So they wondered if something had happened like that to where she was maybe involved in a situation. So they started calling local hospitals, looking around, you know, called police stations. Obviously, they got the police involved, you know, and the police were a little bit skeptical at first. Like, she's only been gone for 2 hours. Like, you know, everybody thinks you got to be missing for 24 hours to make a police report. You don't have to.
Sure.
But 2 hours is a pretty small window unless you have a real reason to believe that something happened.
Well, some people are just so OCD. They're going to be there on every single day the same exact time.
Exactly. And that's what they said. Like, she was always punctual. When she said she was going to be home, she came home. And the other thing that was alarming to them is, again, pre-cell phone era. She called home. She would always call home before she left. You know, knowing like, hey, it's a 20-minute drive for me to get home. I should be home around this time, you know?
Sure.
I mean, even as a 21-year-old, I respect that. You know, like, you're still calling to check in with your parents even though you're 21 years old, right? So this family isn't one to just take this laying down. So it's right about midnight, and the family gets up. She's got some brothers that live in the area. Next thing you know, there's about nine to 10 people that are out actively searching for her, trying to find her car broke down on the side of the road, anything like that. Right. Well, about 12:15, a gentleman named Lincoln Screen, he's driving home from work on Interstate 76 right over by Talmadge Avenue. And he sees a car that's on fire on the side of the road. But like, it's not engulfed in flames. It just looks like somebody haphazardly like set some kind of a small fire inside the car.
Weird.
Right. So he pulls over and he actually flags down a truck driver. And the truck driver has a fire extinguisher in his truck. So the two men are actually able to put the fire out. Literally, it's ironic on the timeline on this. Literally, as they're finishing putting out the fire to where now it's just the white residue and the smoke that's finishing rolling out, a car pulls up. And the car that pulls up is actually Trina's mother, father, and one of her three brothers. And they pull up to the car and they instantly know, hey, this is Trina's car. No question, this is it. So they actually happened to just be in the area because...
I'd say that's pretty weird.
Right, but they decided to check the interstates to see if there had been an accident or something to where... Because she would have taken the interstate to get back and forth from this particular friend's house.
Right.
So that's why they thought that it might be a good place to go. Well, her dad, before he left the house, was smart enough. He grabbed the spare keys to her car. So he had her keys on him. So checked the front of the car, nothing. They go and they actually open the trunk and he opens the trunk and sees his daughter laying there, naked, bound, lifeless. It's clear at this point that she's passed away.
Jeez.
I can't imagine what that moment has to be like as a father to find your own child passed away, especially in a situation like this. So they basically stop what they're doing. The one gentleman that had stopped to help initially, he heads up the road, gets to a payphone, calls 911. To get the cops on their way. So the family stays right there. They said that, you know, we're not leaving our daughter. You know, we're going to stay right here until they come to get her. Well, they notice that there's a set of footprints that's actually leading away from the scene. And it goes right across the highway to a little side street. You ever see like a side street that like ends at the highway? Like you can't get across it. But like,
right.
But like if you jump the median, you can get right there. Well, there's one right there that ends there. It's on Newton Street. So if you guys want to pull up on a map and look at it, it's right where Newton Street runs into 76. And so the cops get there and they point this out and they follow these steps right back to where they're going. Well, there actually is an auto parts store right there. And not to call this an auto parts store, it's not Napa. It's like stuff that this guy's pulled off of other vehicles and
right.
stuff. You know what I mean? It's kind of like the local garage man. Hey, you know, I need a carburetor for a 73 Thunderbird. You know, do you got one? You know, well, he remembers that night there's never any cars in his parking lot, that there was a truck that had been parked in the back of his lot. He said once in a while, somebody would park there. Like if somebody was having a party down the street, you know, they'd park there for overflow parking. He had a good relationship with the neighborhood to where he wasn't really super concerned about it. So they asked him to start describing the truck, and he said that there was a broken grill on the front of the truck.
Right. Here we go.
Right. And he said that he knows that it was there about 11:30 because that's when he went outside to smoke a cigarette. Well, at 1 a.m., right, he's done at that point, and he heads home, and he noticed that the truck was gone. So he figured whoever they're out visiting, whatever, they're just gone. So police now have a timestamp to where they can put this guy right in this area at this time. So the next morning, this story is all over local and national news because they know who they're looking for, right? It's just a matter of being able to hunt this guy down. I mean, this guy's a serial rapist and a murderer multiple times now to where they know that they need to get their hands on this guy. Well, while this is being done, they perform the autopsy on Trina and they actually find semen again to where they have another layer to go on this. Well, later that morning, as everything is unfolding in the media, a guy by the name of Robert Tyson, he knew that it was time for him to pick up the phone and call police. So he calls the Talmadge Police Department and says, "Hey, I know where Benner's at." Benner had actually rented a house in a neighboring town called Canal Fulton. Canal Fulton, 15, 20 minutes away, maybe, but it's kind of an inconspicuous place.
Well, from us.
Right. and back in the 80s, 20 minutes away, it might have been 3 hours away. You know what I mean? Like, you could hide out in a small town like that very easily.
Oh, sure.
Inconspicuous all day long.
It's just it's one of those towns where don't blink, you'll miss it.
Exactly. So they find the house, and ironically, this house had a garage. And they get a hold of the guy that owns the property, and he says, yeah, that he actually owns several properties in the area, that he liked another house better, but this one has a full garage to where the truck was always in the garage unless he was gone. So this guy's trying to conceal that it's his truck and that he lives there.
Sure.
Right? So police descend on the house immediately. Well, they get there and there's nobody home. So this is on the 2nd now of January. So they have somebody on this house 24 hours a day in unmarked cars. The FBI clearly involved in this 24 hours around the clock. Finally, he shows back up. He gets dropped off by another car on January the 10th. A lady drops him off. And before he even makes it into the house, he's arrested on site. And they do charge him with the first degree murder, rape, and kidnapping. Right? So in a statement to police, in another ironic twist, Tyson, the guy that called the police to let him know where he was at, he said that he had worked with Benner at Michael's Construction, was the name of the company that they worked at, and he admitted that he was the thief in the Hale rape and robbery. So he was the number two that was there that is actively trying to rob this woman while she's being raped. He also says that the morning after the Thorogood concert, that they both had to work, and Benner came in and said, "You're not going to believe this, man. I actually killed a girl after that show last night. It's like we had sex, and she tried to say that I raped her, and I didn't rape her, and she started screaming, so I hit her, and then she kind of stopped moving." And that wouldn't end up holding any water with the number of blows that she had inflicted. It wasn't like he hit her once, she hit her head. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not that it's okay to hit a woman one time, but this wasn't a freak accident.
Plus, he left out the strangulation part.
Right. So the other part that's interesting about this that I was very surprised at is that with the DNA evidence not being near what it is today, they were actually to use a little bit of a genetic makeup that they were able to pull from a particular sample. This was actually done down in Columbus at a private lab, and they were able to link him up for Cynthia, Hale, Powell, and Trina's, what's the word, the attacks that were actually on all of them.
Sure.
Right? A couple other things that were interesting that they found is they actually did a search of the home on January the 12th, and they found paint in the house that matched chips that were under Trina's fingernails, so they know that he had her at the house at one point in time, right? And they also found unique carpet fibers that could only have come from this house. Now, I was kind of skeptical about that. When you say a unique carpet fiber, what does that mean?
Trilobal.
Right.
No, I've watched enough of Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah.
And or Forensic Files.
Uh huh.
That they there are different types of fibers.
Yeah.
And like I said, there's trilobal, must be bilobal. I don't know, but.
Well, they said that wherever they had gotten this, it was actually surplus military carpeting, to where the odds of finding this in a civilian home are almost next to zero.
Well, there you go.
So the fact that it was there and matched her, that the odds were astronomical that it could have come from someplace else. And then, ironically, as they were actually finishing their search, they found her coat stuffed in an attic, coat that they could actually match back to Trina. So
what did McConaughey say? All right.
Right? So they've got this guy, right? Well, unbelievably, at trial, he pleads not guilty. So
he's an idiot to begin with.
He's going
to
have the full trial. He would say later in an interview that the reason that he pled not guilty was because the Stark County prosecutor refused to take the death penalty off the case under any circumstances. Basically, there's nothing that you can do or tell us that's going to give me a reason to take this off the table. So he figured at that point he had nothing to lose by at least trying to go to trial for it.
I suppose.
So I guess.
If nothing else, you're just extending your fate.
I mean, right. But like, at that point, they got you. Don't waste time and money. You know what I mean?
You think they don't give a shit.
Not at all. So on April the 7th of 1986, Benner is found guilty on all counts, and it takes less than 3 hours of deliberation to get this done. 8 days later, on April the 15th, he is sentenced to death. Ironically, a couple weeks before that, Tyson, who had actually been a witness at the trial, obviously, he gets 5 to 15 years for his role in the rape and robbery and also aiding and abetting. Was what they had him for. Now, he denies strongly that he had anything at all to do with the rape. They didn't find any of his DNA at the scene for what they could tell. But it's one of the things that Benner said, look, I have no reason to lie to you at this point about anything. I'm telling you, he actively participated in this rape. But they chose not to prosecute him directly for that.
They figured one sheep's enough.
Right.
Yes.
Well,
I don't know why you would not want to take everybody down.
Well, he claimed at trial that he was afraid that if he intervened, that he was going to be killed. Like, okay, but then you didn't go to the police. I mean, we've had this conversation before on other things.
Yeah.
You know, if you're so afraid for your life that you can't do something, because self-preservation is always first for most people, right? You at least have a duty as soon as you are physically able to go get help.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Even if it's 2 days later.
Right.
Go tell the police what happened.
Right. This could have saved two more savage attacks, one that ended up in a murder.
Yeah.
Right? After all said and done, he serves 2 years, 9 months, and 4 days. This guy does less than 3 years for being part of this. And they cited that he was a model prisoner, that he didn't actually have a track record as any kind of a criminal before this. You know, basically, he was caught up in the situation, and they actually cited the fact to the parole board that he was the one who blew the whistle. So who knows how much longer he could have been out there.
Sure. But this guy possibly participated in a rape.
Mm-hmm.
So he quite possibly could be almost as much of a piece of shit as the main guy.
Right. I mean, at that point, what's the point of giving somebody 5 to 25 if they don't even have to serve 5? That's where I struggle with the sentencing part of it. If you put a low number on it, then that's the low number.
There's no common sense.
Right. You can't get below that. Well, there's one more small twist to this that I found to be completely disturbing. And it was actually the relationship that Benner had with Trina. They actually grew up 3 houses apart from each other. And Benner was actually best friends with her brother Rodney growing up. And I mean the best of friends. And she actually hung out with them hundreds of times over the years. The three of them would spend countless hours together on their bikes, swimming, playing, running the neighborhood together where they grew up. And he at one point actually lived with her family. And because of the terrible home life that he had, at the age of 17, he actually tried to commit suicide by overdosing on pills. And Trina's family instead of turning their back on him, they put him into rehab to try to get him turned around in his life to
swooped
see what they could do for him.
In and try to rescue him.
But they'd known this kid for forever. And they're like, we don't just love you now. We love you, like, as part of the family. Well, he chose to not get the help. He ended up leaving the rehab center early and decided to stick with a life of drugs and alcohol, basically, at that point, you know, to where it's crazy that he basically killed his sister. I mean, they were that kind of close, you know, that was actually almost like his sister. Well, all of his appeals failed, and this brings us up to February the 6th of 2008. This is the night before Benner's execution is about to happen. So they asked him if he wants to have anybody come in and see him, right? And he says, no. He said, I would waive having any of my family members come in if you will allow me to make a phone call. So they determine, they get it approved for him to make a phone call, and he actually calls Rodney, his childhood best friend that he murdered his sister.
Jesus.
And the two of them actually talk on the phone for about 90 minutes. And Rodney had stated that, you know, he's never going to give all the details from the conversation that they had. That was a conversation between the two of them. He doesn't want it all over the media and that kind of stuff. But he said, here's what I will tell you. He said, you know, we talked about a few of the good times, which I don't know how you have those conversations, that they had growing up. And they also talked about Trina's murder a little bit. And Rodney had some questions that Benner said, you know, I'm just not going to answer over the phone. He said, I know that they're recording this line. I don't want this information to be shared with the world. I will tell just you, but I'm going to have to do it in person. So he actually contacts the lawyer for Benner and says, hey, can you get this arranged? The state of Ohio, I think mercifully at this point, to give the family some answers, says, yes, we will grant you a face-to-face with them. Right?
You know they wanted to record that shit.
Right. According to testimony, there was no recording devices or anything like that. That they have to where nobody knows exactly what this conversation is. So the next morning, Rodney arrives at the prison. He admitted that he was shaking like a leaf and sweating, and they brought him up in front of the actual cell to where he was able to sit in a chair in front of the cell. They had a conversation that lasted about 17 minutes, and Rodney said that he got all the answers he was looking for and what he felt was a very heartfelt and tearful apology from Benner. You know, that he did say that Benner understood that the execution had to take place for what he had done, and that he just wished that there would be some kind of reform to where they could see the person that you become when you're in prison and not the person that you were then for an opportunity to be commuted. I don't agree with that.
Don't feel bad.
But Rodney said that he actually agreed with that after the conversation that he had with him, and that this really helped give his family some closure and some peace, getting some information on some questions that he had for him. So we may never know exactly what that conversation was. I am glad, for as much as this guy is a turd, that he was willing to give that information up instead of taking it to the grave with him.
I wonder if he made some stuff up, though, just to sugarcoat it. You know, I don't know. I mean, what could you quite possibly tell the family that would make them be at ease?
Right. I can't even imagine.
She died in the woods, right? I mean,
well, no, this was the one that was at his house.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, right.
So Trina was at his house one point, and then they found her in the trunk of the car.
Right, in the car. Right.
Right. So
it didn't matter.
How do you justify any of that? I have no idea. Well, Trina's dad didn't share the same sentiment as Rodney.
Good.
His sentiment was, I hope this guy burns in hell.
You fuck with my kid.
Yeah.
Go to hell.
Right. So the morning of the execution, the father arrives to view the execution, and there's a couple cars that are backed up on the way in, and there's actually protesters that are like yelling at him, you know, because they know what he's there for, right? I mean, they've seen this guy in the media and stuff. He actually rolls down the window, and he tells one of the protesters screaming at him, he goes, I hope it doesn't ever happen to you, but if you're in this situation and it's your daughter, there's no way you're going to be holding that sign. And he rolled up his window and drove inside to where I wouldn't have been able to keep it together right there. I probably would have lost my mind.
I mean, he handled it way better than I would have.
I agree. So to back up just a smidgen, so the night before, he gets his last meal. And this is another one of these. It's almost preposterous that we go to these lengths for these assholes.
8 tubs of ice cream.
His final meal was 4 triple bacon cheeseburgers on butter toasted buns, green peppers, tomatoes, pickles, ketchup, mustard, and mayonnaise on top of each one. 2 fully loaded baked potatoes with butter, sour cream, cheese, and bacon. 2 pounds of French fries, 1 pound of onion rings, 1 tub of macaroni and cheese, 1 chef's salad with creamy Italian dressing, 1 entire blueberry pie, 1 quart of chocolate ice cream, 1 large iced tea, and 6-pack of Coke.
How long do you get to eat this fucking meal?
I mean, right?
There's no way you sit down and you're done in 20 minutes.
Right? I mean, that's unbelievable. So after he was done eating...
Did they get him 4 hours?
I mean, that's what it's insane.
I mean, I got to take a shit, officer. I'll be right back.
How long did it take to prepare this meal? And to get... I mean, that's crazy. I'd have been like, no, here's a cheeseburger, bro.
Ohio, you got to fix your shit.
Yeah, they've got a little bit of work to do right now. That's without saying. So he ends up watching TV for about 3 hours, and he ends up waking up about 5 a.m. So...
comatose from food.
Right? I mean, that'd be the only way I'd be able to sleep, knowing that my execution was coming. Are you going to waste a single minute that you got left with your eyes closed? I wouldn't. Well, at 10 a.m., everybody's seated, the curtains open, and Benner's strapped into the gurney, just like always, right? When he's asked for his last words, he says, "Just give me 2 seconds. Now, I'm going to read this to you, and I don't care how fast you talk, there's no way you're getting this out in 2 seconds. He says, "I've been going over and over in my head, trying to think of the words that I can say that would ease the unimaginable pain that you have been going through for 20 years because of my actions. I am sorry. Trina and Cynthia were beautiful girls who didn't deserve what I did to them. They are in a better place. Words seem futile. All I can say is I'm sorry. May God give you peace." Okay, that's a monologue. He said he's sorry. He doesn't even mention the 2 other women that he viciously attacked and tried to murder, right? I mean, 1 he had to get pulled off of. The other one, he probably thought that he had her murdered, but she ended up waking up and climbing herself off of this snowy hill.
Exactly.
Doesn't even mention those people. So how much remorse do you really have at that point, right? Well, when he gets done, in response, Bradley, who was another one of Trina's brothers that was there, he said, "Well, that's not going to get you into heaven, Ace." Said it audibly, wide open for the room. So I thought, you know what? Good for you. So at 10:08 a.m., the 3 drug cocktail is pushed, and at 10:23, he's pronounced dead. So 15 minutes. And that
sounds like a nice long death.
Right. So that is the execution of Mr. Brenner. So a couple questions. The first one from the moment I've been researching this, I can't understand the court systems at that point in time. How does a convicted rapist get let go to start a sentence months later?
It's unfathomable.
I mean, there should be, I mean, I hate to say it this way, but if it's like white collar crime, you know what I mean? Or like weed. Okay. You know, the jails are a little bit full right now.
Rape.
But right. And like aggravated, like brutal rape. You know what I mean? And the other part of that, speaking to that, is he admitted to that rape, right? Tyson wasn't implicated in it at first, which I found to be ironic. And with the ligature marks around her neck, how did he not get attempted murder for that?
Should have.
I mean, I think they just should. Were they just so happy that he was going to plead guilty and to get this case off their desk that they let that go? I mean, that seems like a complete failure by the Summit County Prosecutor's Office, right?
Big time.
I mean, that's how I looked at it. So that leads me to the next question, which I know we touched on it while we were going through the story there, but how ridiculous is Tyson's prison stay?
Horrible.
I mean, I really hope that on some level that dude got what was coming to him afterwards.
Hopefully.
I mean, I try to not wish ill will on top to people on things, but that's unbelievable. What he could have stopped, and then the tiniest price that he paid for it.
Well, the old saying, "You made your bed, now lay in it." Right.
Right.
I mean, he at some point he had to get what was coming to him.
Right. This is kind of a broad question, and I feel like it pertains to this case. It pertains to a lot of the cases that we see, but is there any avenue to where a person can change in prison and earn the right to have a sentence commuted.
I believe people can attempt to change. I don't know in prison systems. I think we talk about the jailhouse Jesuses all the time. Mm. I don't think from my standpoint, I don't think I have a option to judge that, because your sentence is your sentence.
Yeah.
Deal with it. Sorry. If you want to spend the last 25 years or 15 years of your life in jail trying to save your soul to the Almighty, go for it.
Yeah.
But when it comes down to that question, I don't think it doesn't even matter to me, because it's like, you know what? Like kind of like what I said a second ago, you made your bed, you got to sleep in it.
Right. I agree. And this point comes up a lot. You know, oh, this person that you're executing 25 years later isn't the same stupid kid that made that mistake.
True.
But if that stupid kid makes a mistake at 22 and cuts off his leg, it's not going to magically grow back because he didn't make that same mistake again 25 years later. Things happen in life that you have to accept the consequences for what those are, regardless of how it changes you as a person.
I would like to see. This guy did this in his 20s.
Yep.
If he was in jail for 30 years and got out in his late 50s and let out into the public, I would almost guarantee you at some point in the next decade he would do it again.
I would almost guarantee it.
Even if he was jailhouse Jesus in it or not.
Right. And that's why I don't believe in a commuted sentence for something like this. They're just, unless you find a mitigating circumstance in one of these cases that changes what the actual offense was,
mm-hmm.
I just don't see that there's a way that it should ever even be a question. Whether you gave them what they wanted or not, whether you tried to give everybody as much peace and whatever, you wouldn't be having to give peace if you didn't cause turmoil.
I'm going to also say the jailhouse Jesus thing is a very selfish thing, because it's all about them.
It is.
It's all about them.
Right.
And them trying to become a better saint for their passing. That's all it is.
Right. That's the only piece of hope that they have left,
because mm-hmm.
they have nothing else that they can control at that point.
Exactly.
So the last question, as always, was justice served in this case?
To the main participant, of course.
Yeah.
To the other guy, no.
Not even close. I feel like
he should have got 10 to 15.
And
easy.
So he should have done at least 15. I mean, he should have had to do 15 hard years at a maximum security federal penitentiary.
Mm-hmm.
Because his actions or lack of actions caused part of this to happen.
For sure.
So I agree that this case went the way that it should have. I look forward to telling you another one next time. Make sure that you and anybody that you know, if you have a mental health issue, please call 1-888-622-4357 for the National Mental Health Awareness Line. Somebody on the other end will help you. We promise there's somebody that can help you or somebody you love if you're dealing with a substance issue, a mental issue, anything that's going on. Please reach out. In a situation like this, it might have helped if somebody would have reached out for Benner.
Absolutely. So if you have any ill will towards other people as far as hurting them or yourself, please call the number.
That's right. Thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to talking to you again soon.
Stay safe.